Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for culturalmoney.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Humans are a strange species. We stand up, we cook our food, we talk, and we remember. Our bodies aren't covered in thick fur, and we don't have sharp teeth or claws, and yet we aren't extinct. We live on every continent. How come we're all alive when stronger hominids aren't? How did a tropical species come to dominate cold climates, and what kept us alive for 200,000 years in this great human odyssey? The Great Human Odyssey is also the name of a spectacular new three-part series from Clearwater Documentary that explores our species, Homo sapiens, and what sets us apart. The series was written, directed, and narrated by Canadian anthropologist-turned-filmmaker Niobe Thompson. Thompson grew up in Wabasca, northern Alberta, where he worked fighting forest fires. Later, he traveled the world getting his doctorate in social anthropology from Cambridge University. He went on to make Gemini award-winning documentaries, and The Great Human Odyssey is his most recent. It premiered last night on CBC's The Nature of Things, and I'm very pleased to have Niobe here by telephone from Alberta to tell us more about it. Hi, Niobe.
Hi, Daniel.
So your search for the origins of humans starts in southern Africa. Why?
Well, of course, for most of our past, our evolutionary past, our species and our predecessor species lived in Africa alone. Africa was our only home. And so this three-part series starts with the question surrounding the emergence of this particular model. Homo sapiens is the last model in the line of evolving hominids. And so, of course, we can go deeply back into our evolutionary history in Africa and then finally see the emergence of modern humans, Homo sapiens, in Africa, not too long before we charge out of Africa and begin to colonize other parts of the planet. But we devoted the first episode, as you say, to that story in Africa. And it's a fascinating story, and we're beginning to learn a lot more about it using new tools of research. For one thing, we've discovered that the African climate that we evolved in was never stable. This was the old idea that we evolved in an unchanging savanna environment and over millions of years became the human we know. In fact, the climate record is telling us that we were punished by an always changing climate, and the changes in Africa could happen very quickly. And that really turns on its head a lot of what we believe about our origins.
So is that why we left Africa?
No, I don't think that we can say because the African climate was changing, we sought better pastures beyond. I think we left Africa for a couple of reasons. First of all, living in that ever-changing environment selected over time for a very innovative, clever, social human. The reason we got through these shifts in climate was because we were so good at adapting, at being flexible. And so we had this package of abilities and behaviors that could take us into every ecosystem beyond Africa and help us to adapt to them. But then, you know, there's an even more interesting question, and that's why even make the effort? And I think that gets to the heart of human nature, which is that we are curious. We are risk takers by nature. And I think it is a very human thing to want to know what is over the next hill. And that was the driving force for human migrations out of Africa, I believe.
So when we left Africa, we encountered other species very much like us. We used to think we were descended from the Neanderthal, but we coexisted with other hominid species. Could you talk about this coexistence?
Well, it's useful to use the metaphor of a tree when you think about the evolution of hominids, of the upright walking primates, of which we are the last surviving member. The Neanderthals were on their branch, and we were on our branch. And as we find more fossil humans outside of Africa and in Africa, we're beginning to get a picture of a world that was a lot like Middle Earth, I like to say, in the sense that we were just one of many different kinds of humans. There were Neanderthals. We all know about the Neanderthals and, of course, our ancestors. But we have discovered a new mysterious species called the Denisovans. who seem to have lived in more toward Asia than toward Europe. And then there were hobbits, and not the hobbits that walk around in tweed vests and smoke pipes, but that looked much like hobbits that lived on an island in what's now Indonesia. So there were so many different kinds of humans vying for survival, and yet only we survived. And in that story is 30 or 40,000 years that humans out-competed and eventually out-survived the rest is a story.
So we know these hobbits and Neanderthals are extinct now, but do parts of them live on in modern humans?
Absolutely. You could say that the Neanderthals never died away, because what happened when our ancestors left Africa, we think starting about 120,000 years ago, we met these so-called archaic humans, the Neanderthals and Denisovans, perhaps others, and we had sex with them. We exchanged genetic material with these archaic humans, and so their DNA lives on in all humans outside of Africa today.
Are there people who have a greater portion of their DNA descended from other hominids? Does it vary from culture to culture?
Well, you wouldn't find any Neanderthal or Denisovan DNA in anyone from Africa, pure African today, because they descend from the humans who didn't leave. But everyone who descends from human populations who left Africa have some amount of archaic human DNA in them. But what's really interesting, this is new science, is that we're beginning to get an understanding of why that exchange of genetic material, sex with the natives, as I put it, might have actually given us an advantage. If you go to Austronesia, this is Papua New Guinea, Australia, this region of the world, Austronesians have in their genome an area called the HLA gene complex. And the HLA gene complex, for all of us, is what's responsible for our immune response. And if you look at the HLA genes specifically of Austronesians, they are up to 95% descended from archaic humans. In other words, they descend from humans who exchanged genetic material, interbred with Denisovans and Neanderthals, and then we think they got an immunity, or they got immunity from those exchanges, which served them very well in the environments they lived in. And so you could say that by having sex with the natives, their ancestors got a kind of travel vaccine, without which they may not have survived in the environments they lived.
So let's talk about the difference between anthropologists and filmmakers. When an anthropologist enters a population for a field study, they're loath to influence the people they're studying by changing their technology or their culture. But filmmakers, on the other hand, want to get in and out as fast as they can, as on budget, with the best footage they can find. So as an anthropologist turned filmmaker, how do you deal with this contradiction?
Well, I think that anthropology and the anthropological research method can work in filmmakers' favor if they choose to embrace the principles. You know, one of the things that I was taught to do as an anthropologist was to invest in relationships over a long period of time, so that what you were learning from a culture, you could count on, so that you weren't having a superficial encounter that would give you a false impression of that culture. And I think this is possible for filmmakers. It's difficult. As you say, we're working under a budget, and when we go in with film crews, everything costs money. But this is why, in our case, it took us 3 years to make this film. For a year before we ever brought our cameras into some of these remote locations, like Papua New Guinea or the African Kalahari or the southern Philippines or Arctic Russia, I was already developing relationships with the communities that we eventually filmed in. And, of course, we had the agreement of these communities to do what we did. And I was explaining what we wanted, what our aims were, what a film meant, how we intended to portray their culture, and how that might benefit their community by creating a record. And so I was using this anthropological approach to reaching out to foreign cultures as a film director. And I think that if film projects have that capacity, have time on their side so they can invest in those relationships, it leads to much more authentic encounters, which I think audiences respond to.
So this movie, as you mentioned, all the places you went, it's done on an epic scale from Africa to Europe to the Bering Strait to Papua New Guinea.
Yeah.
How do you create a film that looks consistent when it involves so many vastly different locations?
Well, I mean, in a sense, what's lovely about a film like this is that you do get to travel to very different environments. I mean, there can be no consistency between the world of the African Kalahari in the middle of its summer and the middle of the winter with reindeer herders in Arctic Siberia. But there are questions of intellectual consistency. So we knit together a story, and I'm a real believer in the principles of storytelling and the structure, the universal structure of a story. And so one of the ways that we knit location to one location to the next location is by following my own journey. I'm on camera, and each episode is a journey of discovery. And I tell the audience, I tell you what I want to know, and I tell you where I'm going to try to find out more about this question. And so my own role is like the red thread that weaves through each episode. But then stylistically, we filmed with certain kinds of cameras in certain ways so that you do see certain effects used again and again. We were very lucky to have a sophisticated aerial drone with us on all of our locations, and it was filming with a cinema quality 4K camera, the Red Epic. And so in most of our locations, we're able to get above and then move throughout in a very flowing, seamless way with the kind of footage you only get from that kind of technology. And we also used a high-speed camera, which means a camera that can take many frames per second and gives you gorgeous slow-motion footage. And so some of our most beautiful shots are taken with this phantom camera, where you see movement slowed down to almost imperceptible movement. And that's a different way of looking at the world, but it's a beautiful one.
I was wondering about that. It seems almost like an IMAX film.
Well, I mean, a true IMAX is if you're...
Well, the size of the frame is different, of course, but...
Yeah. There's so many differences about IMAX and the aspect ratio you see in a normal theater or on television. But we are beginning to close that gap because this is the first broadcast documentary in Canada to be shot with the new generation of Ultra HD cameras. They are called 4K cameras, and that describes the resolution. If your viewers understand what HD means in terms of resolution,
HGTV.
4K is high definition, that's right. 4K is four times the resolution of high definition. And
wow.
So we're beginning to close the gap with IMAX, but frankly, IMAX on film is about 17K resolution.
There's a great scene of you explaining what the indigenous nomadic reindeer herders in northern Russia or in the Bering Strait area.
Yes.
While they're skinning a caribou or a reindeer.
That's right, yeah.
So when you're shooting something like this, how do you have your narration while a time-related event is going on? Do you write it as you go? Do you?
Well, that's a real trick, Daniel, actually. And I think I've gotten better with it at time. But it's a matter of wanting to say something, wanting to explain something to the audience concisely, but also being able to jump into developing events. So the scene that you're talking about, the reindeer herders had just killed a reindeer, and it takes only about 15 minutes for the women to carve up the carcass and strip the fur off the reindeer. They do it very quickly because if they don't get the fur off the dead animal, the animal actually cooks inside its own fur. That's how warm that fur is. That's what a good insulator it is. So they're rushing. And I realized this is going to happen, and there's no better way to explain how important all parts of that reindeer will be for the reindeer people than to get in front of it as it's happening and explain it. So, it's just a matter of jumping in and doing your best to give a concise delivery and hoping that what's happening behind you relates to what you're saying. And in that case, it turned out.
Well, it's part of an amazing movie. Thanks so much for talking with me, Niobe.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Daniel. I really enjoyed talking with you today.
I've been speaking with anthropologist turned documentarian Niobe Thompson about his 3-part series, The Great Human Odyssey, debuted Thursday night on CBC's The Nature of Things, repeated on the weekend on CBC's News Network. This is Daniel Garber for CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.